La publicación de ese documento haya sido autorizada al más alto nivel dentro del actual gobierno estadounidense no exime de responsabilidades a los perpetradores. Por el contrario, refuerza la necesidad de responsabilidad penal, indicó. Asimismo, manifestó que por un asunto del derecho internacional, los Estados Unidos tienen la obligación legal de presentar a los responsables de esos delitos ante la justicia y que ningún funcionario debe invocar que cumplía órdenes de superiores al cometerlos para evadir responsabilidades. Jorge Millares, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
El presidente de Venezuela condenó una medida del Senado de Estados Unidos para sancionar a funcionarios venezolanos presuntamente implicados en violaciones a los derechos humanos durante las protestas organizadas por la derecha contra el gobierno de Nicolás Maduro.
Indignación y repudio frente a las amenazas de la Casa Blanca. Desesperado porque nos hemos derrotado en este 2014 y vamos a seguir derrotando a sus títeres, al neofascismo de la derecha, que son títeres a sueldo de los intereses estadounidenses. Desesperados como están, quieren retar a Venezuela con sanciones, amenazas. Creo que si se impone, presidente Obama, la locura de la vía de las sanciones, van a salir muy mal parados.
Más de 42.000 personas han sido ejecutadas durante los primeros dos años del gobierno de Enrique Peña Nieto, cifras más altas que las de su predecesor, Felipe Calderón. Así concluye un registro que cada año realiza el semanario Z. La espiral de violencia aumenta pese a la reformulación de las políticas de seguridad y del surgimiento de nuevas corporaciones policíacas de Peña Nieto, destaca la revista mexicana Proceso. De acuerdo al conteo del semanario Z, mientras que en el gobierno de Calderón, el estado de Chihuahua se ubicó como el más violento al registrar una quinta parte de los homicidios, en lo que va de este gobierno, el Estado de México, del que Peña fue gobernador y actualmente encabeza al también priista Erubiel Ávila, es el más violento e inseguro del país. El corredor conformado por el Estado de México, Guerrero, Jalisco y Michoacán concentran 14.429 homicidios intencionales. En Noticias de México, familiares de los 43 normalistas desaparecidos en Guerrero acudieron el martes al Senado de la República. Allí reclamaron a los legisladores no haber abordado el caso de Ayotzinapa por 7 semanas. Entregaron además un pliego petitorio con 4 demandas centrales: la desaparición de poderes en el estado de Guerrero, cancelación de las elecciones del 2015 en esa entidad, que la Procuraduría General abra nuevas líneas de investigación sobre la desaparición de los estudiantes que incluyan al Ejército y al Gobierno del Estado. Además, que el Estado mexicano autorice al Comité de Desapariciones Forzadas de la ONU a intervenir en el caso Iguala. Los padres de familia no dejaron hablar al presidente del Senado, Miguel Barbosa, quien estuvo acompañado por integrantes de la mesa directiva y por los presidentes de las comisiones de derechos humanos y de seguridad pública. Según reporta el diario La Jornada, entre gritos de "vivos se los llevaron, vivos los queremos", los familiares de los estudiantes de la Normal Rural de Ayotzinapa se retiraron de las instalaciones del Senado mexicano. En la capital peruana, Lima, inició el martes las reuniones de alto nivel de la Conferencia sobre Cambio Climático.
Con la presencia del secretario general de Naciones Unidas, Ban Ki-moon, los presidentes de Bolivia y de los países insulares Nairú y Tuvalu, la COP20 de Lima inició las negociaciones de alto nivel. Uno de los temas de debate, el Fondo de Financiamiento para Mitigación y Adaptación frente al Cambio Climático, que hasta la fecha solo ha cubierto el 10% de la meta planeada.
Pido a los países que no han hecho las promesas para el Fondo Verde del Clima que consideren hacer un compromiso financiero ambicioso en Lima. Tenemos que definir una vía clara para conseguir ese objetivo de 100.000 millones de dólares hacia el año 2020.
A su turno, el presidente Evo Morales reclamó no insistir en cuestiones declarativas. Para el mandatario boliviano, la Convención de Naciones Unidas se centra solo en las consecuencias del cambio climático, mas no en la causa, el sistema neoliberal.
Que los países del sistema capitalista entiendan que más importante es la vida que la plata. Que más importante es el planeta Tierra que acumular riqueza. Que los países del sistema capitalista asuman su responsabilidad. Responsabilidad dejando de ser exageradamente industrializados.
El borrador del próximo acuerdo global para el cambio climático debe ser concluido el viernes 12, según el cronograma de la COP20. De manera simultánea se desarrolla en el centro de Lima la Cumbre de los Pueblos.
Se planea una declaratoria y están coordinando con la presidencia peruana para hacer una entrega oficial de las demandas de la cumbre que se van a estar finalizando en estos días.
Para representantes de la Cumbre de los Pueblos, la solución al cambio climático está en recuperar los saberes ancestrales y evitar la depredación de los recursos naturales. Jaime Herrera, Telesur, Lima, Perú.
En Honduras buscan declarar inconstitucional un artículo que prohíbe la reelección presidencial. José Peraza, desde Radio Progreso, amplía la información.
Las tensiones políticas han vuelto a Honduras y es que varios diputados del Congreso Nacional, en su mayoría del Partido Nacional Partido de Gobierno, presentaron ante la Corte Suprema de Justicia una impugnación al segundo párrafo del artículo 239 de la Constitución Política, que habla de castigos a quienes planteen en el país la reelección presidencial, ya que estarían incurriendo en delito porque en la actual Constitución no se permite la reelección, incrustada en uno de los cuestionados artículos pétreos. El diputado del recién creado Partido Anticorrupción PAC, Virgilio Padilla, asegura que el recurso de impugnación constituye delito y los diputados deben ser castigados.
Además de ser un delito, también constituye un delito moral la petición del Partido Nacional. Porque nosotros el 21 de enero hicimos un juramento. Un juramento que dice: prometo ser fiel a la República, cumplir y hacer cumplir la Constitución y las leyes, de tal manera que este grupo de diputados nacionalistas no honra su palabra.
Ya hay un antecedente en Honduras, el golpe de Estado contra Manuel Zelaya Rosales hace 5 años. Cosas de la vida. Los mismos que dieron el golpe de Estado y defendieron a capa y espada el artículo 239 que prohíbe la reelección, hoy acuden a la justicia porque consideran que el artículo sí es dañino para la democracia hondureña. El diputado del Partido Libertad y Refundación Libre, Bartolo Fuentes, dice que el procedimiento para eliminar el artículo 239 es improcedente. Asegura que el camino es consultar a la ciudadanía si quiere o no la reelección presidencial.
Pues bueno, eso no es una cuestión que lo tiene que decidir un juez, porque lo que tiene que decidir el presidente de la República, ni siquiera los diputados. Eso tendría que ser consultado debidamente al pueblo hondureño.
El presidente Juan Orlando Hernández dijo desde Veracruz, México, donde participaba en la cumbre iberoamericana, que la prohibición para tratar el tema de la reelección presidencial es algo que no tiene sentido. Algunos analistas lo tienen como el más interesado en la reelección. La abogada Blanca Valladares, ex magistrada de la Corte Suprema de Justicia, considera que el Poder Judicial en Honduras se enfrenta a un tremendo desafío, a una prueba de fuego, porque tiene que demostrar ante el pueblo que es un poder del Estado independiente.
Las resoluciones del Poder Judicial cada día se exigen que sean más certeras, que sean realmente resoluciones que atiendan el interés mayor común del pueblo y no a grupos de poder.
En Honduras hay preocupación ya que el recurso será conocido por la Sala Constitucional, la misma que sufrió un golpe institucional cuando el propio presidente Juan Orlando Hernández cambió arbitrariamente y violando la independencia de poderes a varios de sus integrantes. El recurso será resuelto antes de irse de vacaciones navideñas, dijo el presidente de la Corte Suprema de Justicia, Jorge Rivera Avilés. Desde Radio Progreso en Honduras, para Radio Pacífica en Los Ángeles, California, les informó José Peraza.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestro blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblosinfronteras@gmail.com.
Esta ciudad, la propiedad del señor Matanza. Esa olla, esa mina y esa finca y ese mar, ese para mi vida, su propiedad del señor Matanza. Ese federal, ese chivato y ese sacor sin En Estados Unidos, la publicación de un reporte sobre la tortura aplicada por la Agencia Central de Inteligencia a prisioneros durante la administración del republicano George Bush está generando discusión y debate, especialmente algunos aspectos de la tortura como privación del sueño, violaciones sexuales, ahogamiento simulado y otras descritas como enhanced interrogation, es decir, interrogación acentuada o exagerada. La senadora Dianne Feinstein es titular del Comité de Inteligencia de la Cámara Alta del Congreso de la Nación.
History will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law.
La historia nos juzgará por nuestro compromiso a tener una sociedad justa, regida por leyes y la disposición para enfrentar una verdad fea y decir nunca más. En una presentación en televisión, el exdirector de la CIA, Michael Hayden, refiriéndose al tema, dijo que la motivación de la senadora para hacer el reporte sobre la tortura sugiere un profundo sentimiento, pero no piensa que lleva a un reporte objetivo.
I think that's an old male fallback position, and there's no question.
Feinstein respondió ante los comentarios diciendo que eso parece ser una típica reacción de un hombre. Añadió que hay varias personas, incluyendo Hayden, que no quieren que se publique el reporte. Por tanto, una de las cosas que tratan de hacer es reducir o desacreditar a personas conectadas con la publicación de ese reporte. Mike Baker es un exoficial de operaciones clandestinas de los servicios de inteligencia. Él dice que los comités supervisores y de inteligencia del Congreso estuvieron recibiendo actualizaciones sobre las actividades de la CIA, pero eso es típico en Washington. Ellos dicen que no sabían nada de algo cuando se dan cuenta que tendrá un costo político para ellos. Ray McGovern es un veterano de inteligencia militar y ex empleado de la CIA.
Senator Feinstein decided that if she was to have some semblance of credibility as an.
Él dice que en 2007, cuando la CIA destruyó los videos sobre ahogamiento simulado que usaban en la tortura, la senadora Feinstein decidió que si ella quería tener credibilidad en su comité, tendría que investigar el caso, y así fue como empezó todo eso del reporte.
In fact, the enhanced interrogation techniques, some of those were very helpful in gathering information, despite what this report is going.
Por su parte, Mike Baker, defendiendo el uso de la tortura, asegura que no importa lo que diga el reporte, la aplicación de la tortura permitió que la CIA obtuviera información valiosa.
As an army officer in intelligence, I was extremely proud of the then head of army intelligence.
Ray McGovern señala que, como oficial del ejército, él se sintió muy orgulloso cuando John Timmons, entonces jefe de inteligencia militar, se adelantó 3 horas al presidente Bush en una ocasión para decir que ninguna información creíble es obtenida con interrogación abusiva. La historia empírica lo ha demostrado hasta en los últimos 5 años que no funciona, aseguró el general.
What you hear there is a 3-star general who made his career in army intelligence.
La persona que estaba hablando, dice, era un general de 3 estrellas que hizo su carrera profesional en el mundo de inteligencia e interrogación. En esencia, estaba diciendo al mundo que Bush y Cheney estaban mintiendo.
It comes from a literal translation of Verschaftsvernehmung, which are the 2 German words.
El exoficial de la CIA añade que el término de interrogation enhancement fue sacado literalmente del manual de interrogación de la Gestapo de la Alemania nazi.
It is true. You do not get reliable information from torture, but
McGovern subraya que si lo que busca la persona es información no creíble, entonces la tortura es el procedimiento a seguir. Como ejemplo señala un iraquí que fuera torturado para que admitiera que él había llevado gente de Al-Qaeda a Irak para entrenar en el uso de armas de destrucción masiva. Eso permitió que Bush consiguiera una declaración de guerra del Congreso contra Irak.
We were set up to fail. We weren't given enough money, we weren't given enough time, we weren't given.
Algo similar ocurrió con la comisión investigadora de los ataques del 11 de septiembre, dice. Los miembros de esa comisión se quejaron después de que no les dieron financiamiento, ni tiempo suficiente, ni acceso a información clasificada, y la información disponible había sido obtenida a través de la tortura. Ralph Schoeman es coproductor junto con Maya Schoen del programa radial Taking Aim.
Institutionalized torture has been integral to the operation of U.S. imperialism long before the Central Intelligence.
Él dice que la tortura institucional ha existido en Estados Unidos desde antes que hubiera una central de inteligencia, pues el imperialismo norteamericano la usó no solo en las Filipinas, sino contra los grupos indígenas de la Unión Americana. Schoeman añade que lo mismo ocurre en el sur de la frontera y se puede ver en el caso de las fosas comunes encontradas en México cuando buscaban a los 43 estudiantes normalistas.
And the mass graves are all over Mexico and Guatemala.
Las fosas comunes están en todo México y en Guatemala, dice, pues son el producto del trabajo de los servicios de inteligencia que operan junto con los narcotraficantes. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velasco.
En Venezuela, representantes del Comité de las Víctimas de la Guarimba han acudido a la sede de la Organización de Estados Americanos para entregar un documento sobre los hechos violentos ocurridos durante las protestas antigobierno. Karen Méndez, de Noticias RT, con los detalles.
Hasta la sede de la Organización de Estados Americanos en Caracas llegó el Comité de Víctimas. Son todas personas afectadas o que han perdido a sus seres queridos durante las acciones violentas de calle que emprendió la oposición venezolana entre febrero y junio de este año. Todas estas personas solicitan a los organismos internacionales y también a las organizaciones defensoras de derechos humanos ser atendidas, ser escuchadas. Lo único que piden es verdad, justicia y reparación.
Eso es ser copartícipe de la impunidad. O sea, nosotros simplemente lo que estamos luchando es porque no haya impunidad, para que haya justicia. O sea, el pedir la liberación de una persona que promovió al odio, el solidarizarse y decir que la persona es víctima, que se le están violando los derechos humanos, es como contradictorio, porque a nosotros, a todas las víctimas, se nos violaron los derechos humanos también.
Por su parte, el Congreso estadounidense sigue presionando para que se sancionen a funcionarios venezolanos por supuestamente violar los derechos humanos de los manifestantes de la oposición. Sin embargo, distintos analistas internacionales y también defensores de derechos humanos consideran que Estados Unidos maneja el tema de los derechos humanos como un instrumento político para afectar a aquellos países que no sirven a sus intereses.
La historia de violación de derechos humanos de Estados Unidos y de sus países aliados es enorme, ¿no? Y decía que tienen doble rasero, porque entonces los países con los que tiene algún conflicto de intereses o algún conflicto político plantea tácticas vinculadas a sobrevisibilizar hechos que ocurren o a construir nuevos hechos o ficcionar nuevos hechos que pasen por violaciones a los derechos humanos con una intención muy evidente de deslegitimar procesos políticos, deslegitimar gobiernos en función de sus intereses geopolíticos.
El gobierno de Estados Unidos, el gobierno de España y diversas organizaciones como Human Rights Watch y Amnistía Internacional han solicitado la liberación inmediata e incondicional del dirigente opositor Leopoldo López. Sin embargo, el presidente Maduro ha dicho que ninguna presión internacional va a evitar que...
Y es todo entonces en inglés. Now it's time for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. That's a twice-weekly show. Today is December 11th, a rainy, rainy December 11th, 2014. I'm Robert Norris. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. We're also, of course, streaming at freakradio.org. And if the power goes out, well, then the power will go out. But in the meantime, we proceed. There's been lots of threats of the power going out from the assassin rain, wind, and thunder. I haven't actually heard the thunder, so maybe it ain't happening. But it certainly is raining out there, and it's pretty darn wet for folks trying to find a place to get out of the rain. When we called yesterday from Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, to the 211 warming center number, we found no warming centers. And we called the police station. They had no suggestions other than the homeless lack of services center. When we called them, they didn't know what to do either. So good luck, everybody out there. Anyway, let's get on with the show. And if you want to call in, the call-in number is 831-427-3772. And, well, let's begin.
I'm tired of moon songs.
cartoon songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle.
That's the old KPFA theme song from the 60s for one of their shows, as well as a tune from Pins and Needles, a 30s musical, which I've been playing through in part in the last couple of shows. You're listening to Bathrobespierre's Broadsides. I cover civil rights, or the struggle to attain civil rights here in Santa Cruz, and give you updates on the stuff I'm closest to, and hence... Well, I feel like I know the most about, or think I do anyway. A lot of things have been happening around the, well, most recently, the stuff I'm interested in covering concerns the city council's response to the community, which is to lock it out and shut it down and ignore it, and essentially rubber stamp the police department's latest armored personnel vehicle request for... acceptance of a grant from the Homeland Security Department, which happened at the last city council meeting day before yesterday. And unfortunately, due to their technical difficulties and mine, the audio and the video of that city council meeting, or parts of it, are not yet available. I'm also hoping that activist Brent Adams, who has seemed to be busy videoing away, will be able to get us some of his stuff posted. He said he was working hard on it last night. He's got a lot of stuff to do, I imagine. He's also working on his warming center project. I don't know how that's going, but if anybody has any updates on warming centers, drying centers, shelter centers, I guess there's the metro where you can get out of the rain temporarily. If the first alarm thugs or the metro security, whoever's covering that, don't get you first. Anyway, call in with updates on what's going on out there in the rain. We are also happy to serve as a community, both listening post and voice, if you have breaking news about the storm. And that's 427-3772 if you want to call in. 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, that's us. Again, as I said, I focus on particular issues in this show for the next 2 hours, but that doesn't mean I won't allow others in as well, of course. So, Well, A big issue, of course, nationally and I think locally, has been the lack of transparency, accountability, and the kind of casual forms of discrimination that police departments across the country and our police departments, whether it's the sheriffs or the Santa Cruz Police Department or the University of California Police, Parks and Recs Rangers, those individuals who are entrusted with the force in order to enforce the rules that have been set down by really unrepresentative bodies, as far as I can see, as in terms of, I'm going to be called on that one because there are elections, you know, and you can vote for the funded candidate of your choice. The others don't have any chance of winning. And, you know, there are those who claim that people vote with their dollars and all that sort of thing. But in terms of how income is distributed, in terms of how the power is distributed in our community, I think we live under a system of rules that very few of us had any part in forming or in agreeing to. So it's not that like you've agreed to live in this society. It is more you're stuck in the middle of it, and it has got its foot on your neck, depending on... and you can actually be a part of the guy with the boots if you want to join the boot crowd. There are jobs, whether it's in the military or the police, or if you those who they serve, if you can get into those positions. Some people are born into them, others make money into them and so forth, make money and get into them that way. But I think for the majority of people, it is not something that really has any relationship to a democracy or any relationship to a basic commitment to human rights or a fair sense of community in terms of representing its wishes, its concerns, and just fairly distributing its resources, or at least making minimal resources available to everyone and not treating people like bags of garbage. So, across the country and coming up this Saturday in Santa Cruz, there's going to be continuing protests. There are continuing protests day after day, night after night, sparked by the exposure of the Ferguson Dirty Laundry, where it became clear that it's been clear for years to anybody looking, but nonetheless, it became nationally embarrassing to see Michael Brown, and then in New York City, Eric Garner, and in other places, whether it's in Phoenix or in Denver or in Cleveland, people, particularly people of color, young people of color, shot down like dogs, and their murderers, because they wear blue and have uniforms, not even prosecuted. At least that's happened in the two cases in Ferguson and New York City. And this, to me, has provided an opportunity, I think, in Santa Cruz for us to consider broader issues of how the police department has acted through the years. I mean, our police department has shot down people, too. I'm only really familiar with more distant cases, like the shooting of Happy John Dine in the fall of 1997 by Officer Connor Carey, who alleged he was waving a toy gun about. And this is a fact denied by every non-police witness, and we interviewed a dozen of them. And we took it to the then Citizens Police Review Board, and they refused to investigate it with an independent investigator. They simply upheld the police department, ditto the district attorney. Again, seemingly in the teeth of the evidence. And we, some of us from Huff, Becky Johnson and I notably, but others as well, raised the issue of the Button Street shooting of Brian Andrus. And there have been other cases as well where the Santa Cruz Police Department simply is not held accountable for what it does. We had in place between 1994 and 2003 a police review board that had been initially stripped of a lot of its power in attempts to schmooze and maintain good relations with the police department, thanks to former city council member, mayor, and resource center for nonviolence guru Scott Kennedy, and Catherine Byers as well, who's only recently retired from the council a couple years ago. So we got a police department that was really essentially stacked with people who were really concerned with hearing from the police department what was really going on and not really providing any meaningful oversight. The one person who was on the police review board who was seriously committed to that, John Malkin, who is a free radio broadcaster now and an author, and you can hear his show on Wednesday nights from, I think it's 6 to 8 or is it 7 to 9? Somebody's stolen the schedule here. The Great Leap Forward, his show is called. He wrote his paper coming out of UCSC on a shooting of a man at Ocean and Water Streets back in 1990-91. That was Carlos Machado, another killing by the Santa Cruz Police Department, where apparently they also shot their own dog and then, you know, claimed that it was because the guy was shooting at the dog that they shot him. I may not be remembering that with all the accuracy, but Malkin was on the Citizens Committee for a Civilian Police Review Commission, I think it was called. And they, a number of lawyers, there was a lot of activism in town around that, which, frankly, was started by homeless activists before it happened. It became came out of a homeless case where a certain officer, now a hailed hero, Lauren Butchie, what I called him, Sticky Fingers Baker, who was shot dead along with Elizabeth Butler in a domestic deal at the house in an incident about a year and a half ago. But he himself was accused by 10 women of molesting them, improperly searching them, fondling them. And the initial report came from Sarah Hillman, who was a homeless woman, in a trial where she was resisting the claim that she was panhandling. And apparently from her perspective, he was handling her. And it was more hand-handling, I guess, with Sergeant Lauren Butchie Baker. And it has really pissed me off that the history of this officer has been so whitewashed and elevated because of how he died. And, you know, I always have to add the caveat, I don't want anyone to die. I don't want police officers to die. I'm not calling for people to kill the pigs, you know, all that stuff. But you got to look at the reality of what the career of this officer, and more important than what we're talking about now, are the careers of current police officers, the policies of the current police department in Santa Cruz are. And HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, has been interested in particularly the profiling the police department does on poor and homeless people. I was kind of zipping back into the history of the police review board. And the reason I kind of wandered back in there and talked about John Malkin and the various earlier shootings is not merely to talk about that our police department has similar problems to other police departments in its lack of accountability, lack of transparency, lack of community control and community involvement in terms of really having not being the community not being pawns of and sort of auxiliaries to the police department, but actually taking the kind of control of the police department that they need to do so the police department does not continue as an occupying force, which is really not just how it's perceived in many places across the country, but how I tend to perceive it, particularly given the way the new tactics where you see police department massing downtown to deal with trivial infractions, harassment, intimidation as a sort of the way of maintaining order, where order means don't sit next to a building, don't be here for more than an hour, all this crap, which is fundamentally class legislation and anti-homeless legislation, and it's sort of a cultural war on a particular class of people. And, of course, that's the main thing that I talk about on the show. Anyway, there's a protest coming up Saturday, which you can read about on Santa Cruz Indie Media, and I'll mention it to you for those who are driving and or perhaps want to have access to Santa Cruz Indie Media. It's in the calendar section. It's also mentioned under the local news, National Day of Protest, March Against Police Violence, 1 to 3 p.m., Clock Tower, Please join Project Pollinate, the NAACP, Resource Center for Nonviolence, and community members of Santa Cruz County and abroad on Saturday to protest at the Clock Tower, sign of solidarity with those who have been victims of the U.S. justice system, and to denounce national police brutality and militarizations of our nation's civil servants. Encourage everyone to come and be a part of the rally and demonstrate to show your solidarity as we call for serious systematic change in police accountability. Demonstration will be marching from the Clock Tower starting at 1:30 and ending at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 3 p.m., where it will be followed by an in-depth discussion forum titled White Supremacy, Violence, and the Criminal Justice System. Throughout the march, the group will stop and listen to speakers who include everyone from professors, doctors, and lawyers to community leaders, students, school teachers, veterans, and more. Don't miss this powerful moment in Santa Cruz history as we band together to let the system know we're mad as hell and we're just not going to take it anymore, and we're just going to talk it to death in the Resource Center for Nonviolence, I guess. Although, actually, that's not entirely fair. I think a number of events are planned along the way, and you never can tell what will develop out of a march where people are upset about not just what's happening abroad, but what's in other cities, but what's happening in our town. And that's, of course, what's, as ever, missing from this particular protest's description. I was sort of a part of a little bit of the planning of this protest. I mean, I'm a supporter of it, for sure. I've written about what the kinds of reforms that I suggest. Reforms isn't quite the word. It's more like fundamental changes, I would say, rather than reforms that I think need to happen. And that we can see that there's a lot of sentiment bubbling. The protesters shut down the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. Actually, it was stupidity and the heavy-handed, we have our rules and you will obey them or we will wrap you on the knuckles approach of outgoing Mayor Lynn Robinson that really prompted, I think, the problems at the council. It was about this purchase of an armored rescue tank, as I call it, though. It doesn't have treads and have a turret, but it looks like, if you see a picture of it online, it looks like a military armored personnel carrier, and actually that's what it is. It carries, quote, first responders to here, there, and everywhere, and the city council specifically refused to rule out using it against peaceful protesters, as it has apparently been used in other cities, though I don't have the specifics on that. Anyway, I did call for some for us to push for some changes in the police department, and the suggestions I made around here somewhere. Let me take a look and see if I can find them. Yeah, one moment as I plod through the... Well, it's here somewhere. I'm going to be talking about the City Council's actions on Tuesday at greater length on Sunday when I have a longer show from 9:30 to 1. Mainly because I'm hoping that by that time, although this is maybe probably a vain hope, though there will be either a video and audio tape available from Brent Adams and or the Santa Cruz Community TV, which or possibly somebody who made a video, captured the video as the city council was happening. And that's really, it's really more about two things, about people empowering themselves in a very heartening way at city council and realizing they have rights that the city council cannot simply wave away or talk away or just sort of announce away because they have suddenly decided their rules do not allow for those rights. And it's also an example of people becoming aware of the issues. It's well of both how the city council operates, how it operates now, and how it really should operate, and the abusive way it is behaving, not just on this issue of the armored personnel carrier, but just generally. Or at least that's been something I have been commenting on with disturbing regularity, and will continue to comment on, although it's also often brought to my attention, why do you bother? I mean, and that's certainly true, too. I I will talk a little bit about the council first. But before I do, I'm going to play a little music that I picked up from the street so you can hear something other than me fumbling about trying to arrange this and that and jumping from one subject to another. You can join this musical chairs on the air with a quick phone call, 427-3772. 427-3772, and we can talk. Were you at the city council meeting? What kind of changes need to come in our police department, if any? What needs to be done beyond a number of hearty speeches at the town clock, a symbolic die-in, and then a forum at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in the days ahead? Not to entirely diminish those events, but to say, you know, what are we going to go that goes beyond the usual wringing of our hands and suggesting we need to retrain the police department? 427-3772. Give a call. Tell me what you think. Somewhat difficult recording. So what happens when you buy these things on the street, I suppose. This is some music from Calambalone. Michael Maisley actually sold this to me. Michael Maisley is a performer that used to perform in Santa Cruz, and I ran into him in Berkeley recently. He was part of the group of performers who stood against the city council's attempt to criminalize juggling in the summer of 2003, which activist and bubble blower Tom Noddy brought up. Actually, he was simply trying to get the city council to do what it said it was going to do when it actually passed repressive ordinances the year before that threw out the street performers' guidelines and the voluntary street performers' guidelines that had served Santa Cruz, in Noddy's view, quite well for 22 years. My view, too, pretty much. These are guidelines that say, essentially, we're not going to call the police. These aren't laws on the books, but if you're playing for in a spot and somebody comes along, whether it's a merchant who's getting tired of hearing the same tune, or another performer who wants to use a spot, or, I don't know, somebody else, and they ask you to move along, you don't move along then. You don't, even if you've been playing for 5 hours, you don't move along. But you agree that after another hour, you will move along. And in essence, it sets us up sort of a buffer, a mode of communication, a set of kind of understandings that peers use, and a kind of peer pressure is made available there, where instead of having an armed thug in blue or one of their little snitch helpers from the yellow-jacketed hosts come up and hassle you with a big smile, pretending all is well and that they still like you and that they're doing this for your own good and they're trying to help you out and it's only the law and all that sort of thing. In other words, instead of trying to force you or pressure you or coerce you, there's simply an attempt to say, look, somebody else wants the space. Are you up for that? Or they're getting really tired of hearing. Can you move, move down a bit? And it's not 100 feet. You don't have to be gone for 24 hours. None of that stuff. That was all added by an anal city council member who had a real misunderstanding of Santa Cruz's ordinances. And as Tom Noddy sees it, this is his perception. I pick up a lot of this from him, but not all of it. He saw in Santa Monica they were doing things differently. And he wanted to kind of pick up on their laws in Santa Monica, which has a large pedestrian mall, or did. I think they still do, actually. Anyway, I'm going into this now because I'm realizing that this is something that it's going to be coming up sooner than the stay away orders, which also are coming up in January. Stay away orders is an issue that came up at City Council in the last few months. It involves criminalization of homeless people by making them stay away from the parks and other park and rec controlled areas at the whim of a parks and rec ranger or officer if they can find a way of giving you any kind of infraction ticket. And they don't have to justify it. They just have to do it, and then they can give you stay away orders. Right now it's for a day. But as of January 11th, when the City Council returns, if they pass this, as they're likely to, then a month from that date it will become law, and you will have to, stay away for periods of time from a day all the way up to a year, depending on the which side of bed the cop or ranger got out of, or how he views you, or how she views you. It's not going to be good. But that doesn't come up for a while. What does come up on December 25th are the new ordinances. Now, in fact, what's coming up even more quickly are the which we're now in the middle of are the police. The reality of people, not of particularly immediate examples in the last week or two, although there are some that have been brought to the attention of Huff. Of police abuse, or what the individuals who reported them consider to be police abuse, but the ongoing anger and resistance and refusal to accept police abuse, which is far more important, and that's really the wonderful thing that I think is going on across the country, and I'm hoping that we can use here in Santa Cruz to bring up the issues that have really been of long standing, but that we haven't been able to come together on. Some people call for a citizen police review board. Again, we had one before. I talked about it a little bit. It's been tried in different cities. In some places, police commissions can have some power if they can fire and hire officers. I don't claim to really be an expert on police review boards. I do know what happened here was the police review board was created in a weakened form. That was bad enough. It was denied regular independent investigatory capability. It was denied independence of the city manager. It was denied any kind of disciplinary powers. But it was given subpoena powers, and it was given the power to issue policy statements, and it was given certain powers, which it generally it was not given the power to review individual complaints, and to receive individual complaints, and to keep a record of individual complaints, so that the police department couldn't keep them secret as they now do, turning them into personnel matters. And requiring you to go to court to get a pitchess motion to find them and get a judge's okay. There's this incredible amount of privilege that police departments have in this state and this country. They have very powerful lobbies, and they're able to exploit myths and fantasies about their necessity and the so-called risks of their job. And they internalize this a lot. I mean, I pointed out a couple of I think it was last show, the claim at least by Christian Williams in his book Our Enemies in Blue, which he quotes from U.S. Department of Labor statistics, I believe, or other government studies around 2000 that show that many professions are far more dangerous than the police department, ranging the most important, I think, being, I don't know, timber cutters to even gardeners or groundskeepers, actually, the word was, truck drivers, all two or three times more dangerous. Well, some of them two or three more times more dangerous than the police department. In terms of the injuries on the job, in terms of fatalities, whether through accidental or intentional causes or sources, that doesn't stop the police department from both advertising how dangerous it is and then also lobbying for restrictions of civil liberties and increases in their powers, which actually tend to back up and multiply the prospects of violence. And, of course, the violence that the police inflict upon those that they violate, whether they're guilty or innocent, is, you know, I don't know, 5 or 10 times that of that inflicted on the police. Of course, the police are better armed. They're the occupying force. So the question is, how do you get, you obviously want to have some method of the communities getting together to deal with problems of theft, problems of violence, problems of fraud, you know, real problems that come up in society that are not fantasies, that are not just advertising by police departments to want more money, or drug war warriors who don't mind filling up the prisons and building new ones endlessly. They're real problems. Well, one of the things that's discussed in the vaguest way, as he usually does, is the Police Review Board, and there's an article by Steve Plaich online, if you want to go and check that out, the Santa Cruz Indy Media. I think anything, any body that has some public accessibility is always an entree to raising issues of what the police need to do. I mean, the most recent thing I've asked the police to do is to reveal their vague procedures for tasering and pain compliance holds and choke holds and when they can draw their guns and when they can use their batons, but specifically when and where this has happened and against whom in the last couple of years. And so far, I've gotten this sort of, we can't give you that information. We don't have to tell you that. And I'm persisting and saying, yes, you do. I'm a reporter on this issue. You are required by the Public Records Act to reveal specifically all kinds of details of every arrest, when it happened, where it happened, and so forth. And let's see if they do. There's a Public Records Act due in 4 days, and I heard from Jackie Dressler, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing. Sorry, Jackie. That she will be getting to this next week, and I'll probably maybe get some information. And in fact, I've got to be honest, the police department has provided me with not the direct stats, but that citations that enabled us to determine that Officer Bradley Barnett was, in fact, ticketing African-Americans downtown for trivial infractions at about 7 times their rate in the population. And that as far as homeless people went, it was more like, 75% of the tickets went to homeless people, and they are, 3% of the population. So that's, 20, 25 times their representation in the population. That's called profiling, racial and class profiling, or selective enforcement. What it really amounts to is using the police force as a kind of, in part of a cultural war that is being used to run people away. Or else, I guess if you want to be more charitable, you can say laws specifically designed to catch and criminalize homeless people that most people don't have to pay any attention to. Most obviously, that's the sleeping ban. But the sleeping ban is not the major law that impacts people downtown. Things like smoking, skateboarding, sitting are the main crimes downtown. And these are also things, homeless people are more likely to have less options. And also, in terms of smoking, as I've said many times, to be more likely to be addicted to smoking than other people. 70% of the general population, that's 1.7%. 70% of the homeless population smokes, is what one study found. And even our friend Pamela Comstock, the most reactionary member of the Santa Cruz City Council, had to acknowledge that she had no figures to counter that. Once she accused me of not speaking truly, and I said, here are the figures, and she sent me the one and only email I've ever received from her that said, yes, you're right on that. So, what can we do here in Santa Cruz to deal with the police? I've just got thoughts that we can talk about and think about. More important that we have to demonstrate about, protest about, and demand action around. We have to, of course, examine, since it's become fashionable again to talk about a Citizen Police Review Board. Simba Kenyatta is also talking about it. Why the first effort failed. And I talked a little bit about that. What that really is all about is when they finally got people of color and people, more important, people have been subject to police brutality themselves and police harassment, like Mark Half Moon, came to chair the commission. And there were others on the commission who began supporting an attempt to look into such issues as selective enforcement of laws downtown in a proposal presented by activist Sherry Connable, such as use of force when the police, as I was asking for in this Public Records Act request recently, and hopefully we'll get information on next week, such as racial and class profiling. When these questions began to be raised in a real way, the city council quickly moved to destroy the board, and it was disbanded without even really giving the board any advance notice, any chance to complain or to discuss or to defend itself. It's sort of the standard way that it's not the city council, you see. People should have to understand this. The city council is a tool of the staff. The staff and the city manager and the department heads are the real powers in Santa Cruz. Very right-wing, very conservative, and they are institutionally well-funded. Their salaries dwarf that of city council members. I mean, Martine Brunel makes over $200,000 a year. So does Danette Shoemaker. I believe so does Chief Kevin Vogel. Heads of these departments are well-to-do, if not wealthy, people. And they're there for life. They're there until they get kicked out. I mean, there was supposed to be a performance evaluation of the city attorney and the city manager 2 days ago at the city council, and I suppose there was, but it happened behind closed doors at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't announced. There was that great liberal Micah Posner and Don Lane had no particular concerns about any of these folks. They don't want to actually, you know, alienate any of these people. You know, you don't. I mean, if you're going to alienate the staff, you've got troubles, and that's the whole trouble with running for city council at all. Because if you do. And people said, why don't you run for city council, Robert? And the answer is, I don't suggest anyone run for city council for a number of reasons, unless they understand they're doing so to simply as a forum to speak out on issues. Because if you actually got onto the city council, it would change you. You wouldn't change it. Unless you came to city council with a determination to have a whole independent source of power, both in the streets and have your own staff with you. That's what I tend to believe about that. But what about the police department? Well, the real issue, involves a number of concerns here, which I'm trying to draw up here. But the let's see what we got. Maybe we do. We have it here. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, I suggested, let's say, 7 things to begin with. Let's reveal, ban, or limit tasers, batons, guns, pepper spray, choke holds, and pain compliance holds, to start with. These kinds of intimidating tools, which essentially allow rule by terror by police forces, are something I think we should consider abandoning. demilitarize and downsize a bloated department that serves as a merchant security squad. Too much money and too many cops are going into the police department. Now, what about real crimes? Doesn't this, you know, take the pressure off assaults on women, sexual abuse, sexual assault, white-collar crime? Well, what kind of pressure are we getting now is really the question I would ask. I suggest that we refuse drug war money, military equipment, and surveillance technology. I suggest we require all SCPD officers to live in the city, if not the local districts they police. I suggest that we end harassment citations, stayaways, and arrests of poor and homeless people for non-criminal but illegal behavior. That is to say, the kind of laws created by city council under pressure from bigoted residents who simply want to run homeless people out of town. Focus on white-collar crime, abuses against workers and tenants, rape, and real crimes. Swift suspension and prosecution of criminal cops with clear histories of violence or abuse. These are, you know, just seven suggestions as to what we can do. They don't even involve disbanding the police department. Limiting tasers, batons, guns, pepper spray, chokeholds, and pain compliance holds would certainly go a long way, I think, to improving the image of the police department, except for those who, you know, wanted to run around acting like the Wild West or the TV series, or, you know, there's a lot of propaganda to overcome. But we're beginning to see the reality of the pain and the suffering and the police violence that's created by allowing this kind of fantasy to replace what's real in our minds and before our eyes, what's really going on in departments across the country and in Santa Cruz, too. So I'd like to see the protest this Saturday spend some time focusing on this stuff. I don't think they will. But I think, I mean, I'll try to raise them, but I haven't been asked to speak at this protest, for example. I had to kind of push to speak at the last protest because Simba Kenyatta heads the NAACP now. He previously headed SCORE, and I've been rather strongly critical of both organizations. Not initially. I asked them, you know, SCORE, what did you do with all the complaints you got from people of color 6 or 7 years ago when you made a big deal, a big advertising campaign running around to four different places in the county holding hearings and getting, and this was good, getting input, and they just can't find the lost complaints. And it's bullshit, man. It's like the ACLU. They're bullshit, too, in that regard. And I see that someone seems to be calling in. Try again, caller. I'm afraid the phones have been turned down, so I'm going to turn them up, as you can now hear. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Robert. This is Fanon from Berkeley.
Oh, hi. So, give me your name again so I pronounce it properly.
Fanon.
Fanon. So, Fanon, I don't know. Have you been listening to the show, or are you? You could hear it on the internet if you want, but are you calling in cold here?
I'm calling you cold.
Well, that's fine. I, of course, contacted, you know, Steve Argue here, and he contacted, I guess, Richard Chen, who contacted you because you're on the scene in a massive protest that for the first time in decades have begun to hit the streets in Berkeley on local issues. And I guess it's international, it's national too, but, well, I should ask you that. Are the protests in Berkeley, you've been involved in them recently, yes?
Correct.
Are they at all involved in any local issues around the Berkeley Police Department as well as solidarity with people being killed by police in other cities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Berkeley has had a few shootings by police, but also Oakland is a hotbed for police shootings of unarmed individuals, especially black and brown individuals, and, you know, Berkeley and Oakland, you know, sort of go hand in hand. We're, you know, right next door to one another, and we protest together usually.
And so what's happening? I know that the most amazing thing about these protests, both up in Berkeley and Oakland and elsewhere, is that they seem to be, to some extent, sustained over the last, well, certainly in Ferguson, day, you know, month after month, but also in California. What's your take on that?
You know, I mean, people always like to compare these protests to Occupy, you know, a few years ago. And I personally see these protests as having much stronger legs, and it'll have a much more lasting impact than Occupy did, chiefly because the people who are at the front of these protests are the people who are materially affected by repressive police forces. You know, these protests are by and large being led by black and brown communities in Oakland and to a lesser extent in Berkeley. And I think that's sort of what gives them the strength. You know, with Occupy, you know, you had a lot of students and sort of people with relative levels of privilege. And if shit hits the fan, you know, they can just sort of go home. But that's not the case for, you know, people living in communities affected by police brutality. They can't just go home. I mean, the brutality follows them. So they don't, you know, they don't have a choice. You know, this is their life. And I think that's a big reason why these protests have such, sustained energy, because they're finally being led by, you know, black and brown communities who are materially affected by this oppression.
Tell me something about the protests. For example, are people swimming through the rain to protest tonight, as far as you know?
I don't think anybody is going to be protesting tonight. I mean, you know, some people might go out, but I think that for the most part, people are saving their energy for Saturday. There's a big action. There's going to be a group meeting in San Francisco and a group meeting in the East Bay who are going to march and converge on the Bay Bridge to block the Bay Bridge, at least is the goal. I think people are saving their energy for that and not bothering to go out in this deluge of rain.
So if people want to join...
That's at least my plan.
I hear you. I didn't want to go out myself even to the radio station. But how do people join the protests in San Francisco or Oakland? How do they get more information about them?
It's all on social media. I mean, some of these protests get announced hours in advance on Twitter and on Facebook. People are just, organizing through social media pretty much. There are some groups that are nominally trying to organize these protests, but really they have no real control. In fact, there was this one group, By Any Means Necessary. It's kind of ironic because they're actually sort of a milquetoast liberal group that has, appropriated the language of Malcolm X to sort of sell their sort of, preservation of the status quo liberal ideology. I actually blame that group specifically for all of the vandalism that took place last Saturday and Sunday when, a lot of the banks were smashed and different businesses were smashed. The reason being is because this group was trying to lead protesters, away from, say, blocking freeways, or, they didn't want us to go and confront the police at the police station. They were sort of trying their best to neuter the march and prevent any meaningful direct action from taking place. And so they just sort of led the march up and down Shattuck, and people took out their frustration on storefronts because they weren't able to actually engage in any meaningful direct action. So a lot of people were blaming sort of white anarchists for a lot of the damage that took place during some of those protests. But in reality, I blame the white moderates.
who sort of tried to neuter the protests and prevent any real direct action from taking place. I mean, later on when we just, you know, started ignoring those quote-unquote organizers and just, you know, marched straight for the freeway, you know, businesses weren't being smashed because people were able to vent their frustration in a meaningful and direct way that wasn't just, you know, mindless destruction. And I think that's an important point that I think a lot of people are missing when watching all of these protests, is that it's really the liberal moderates who you can blame for most of the worst aspects of these protests.
And were you present when the, you know, tell me about the freeway blockage and the reaction of the police and assorted activities, and can you give me kind of a chronology how this went down day after day, if, insofar as it did?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think pretty much every day that we've been out there, we have at least blocked the freeway for at least a little bit of time. Obviously, the most dramatic blockage was Monday night when the 80 was shut down for hours. And then there was that, you know, mass arrest of, I think, like 267 people, of which I was one. So, you know, there's been several freeway blockages at this point. It's hard to even remember all of them. But definitely Monday night was the most dramatic, example. I think we had the 80 shut down in, you know, pretty much rush hour traffic for 3 hours or longer. So that was, you know, really, really dramatic statement, and really got a lot of news attention. I think we were, you know, front page of the New York Times, for instance. So we definitely got a lot of attention, and that's, I think, why people are, you know, taking these direct action tactics, is because it's actually making people pay attention, and it's actually making this the problem of the privileged instead of just the problem of black and brown communities. And I think that's what's so important here. You know, a lot of people say, you know, what are you trying to accomplish by blocking a freeway? Well, we're trying to get you to pay attention. That's what we're trying to do. And it's obviously working very successfully, because otherwise you wouldn't be asking what we want. So now,
who's asking what you want?
You know, again, usually white liberal moderates.
We don't understand,
you know, the concept of direct action.
It always
reminds me of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. Are you familiar with that at all?
At one time I read it, a long time ago.
Yeah, in that letter he talks about how he's become convinced that the greatest threat to the American Negro is the white liberal moderate, even more so than the citizen counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner. The white liberal moderate who, and I believe this is a direct quote, prefers a peace that is a negative peace that is the absence of tension rather than a positive peace that is the presence of justice. Who says that, you know, I can agree with your goal, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action. Who says to be patient, who says to wait for more convenient seasons. You know, those are the type of people who are actually the biggest hurdle, I think, for this movement, much as they were in the 60s.
So you were arrested on Monday night?
Correct.
And you were held for what, number of hours?
I was, I guess, naive enough to volunteer to be arrested first. Or among the first, I think I was like the fifth person to volunteer to be arrested, and they had me zip-tied for over 5 hours at the scene while they were arresting everybody else. You know, a lot of us were zip-tied for, you know, and in agony for an incredibly long period of time before we were even loaded onto buses for the hour-long trip to Santa Rita. I guess it was maybe a 40-minute trip to Santa Rita. And then once we were there, we were put into holding cells and, you know, had our information taken several times. And, left in a cell with steel bunks with no mattresses at all for hours. And then eventually in the morning we were released, just cited and released.
What were you charged with?
It was very...
What were you... Sorry, Fan, what were you charged with?
To the jail to sweat them, you know, as sort of a punishment. I mean, usually in those situations they would just cite and release, but it was very clear that they were trying to be punitive with us in whatever way they could.
So what were you cited for?
The Penal Code 647C and Penal Code 370. One is blocking a roadway and the other one is public nuisance. Both misdemeanors and honestly both likely to be dropped. You know, they illegally detained us for an hour. When they tabled us, they refused to tell us whether we were detained or free to go, which they're not, you know, that's against their regulations. They're supposed to tell you if you ask them, am I detained or am I free to go? They're required to answer you, and they didn't do that for over an hour with us. So that could be considered an illegal detainment.
There's been
and then on top of that, there was never a dispersal order given, which... you know, some of those charges rely on the fact that a dispersal order was supposed to be given, which we then disobeyed. You know, all 270 of us can agree that we never heard any sort of dispersal order. In fact, the first time we engaged with the police, really, on the freeway, we were pushed off the freeway into the parking lot. You know, so we did disperse, and then we were arrested in the parking lot.
So, I know, you know, here in Santa Cruz, I and others were charged with felonies for occupying a building peacefully. Actually, I just was in there reporting on it. Others were occupying it, but I was there. And we didn't hear any order. They didn't give any order, actually, too, and similarly. But they still charge people with conspiracy and felonies. Has that happened much up in the Bay Area?
You know, I haven't heard of people being charged with felonies associated with the protests. I mean, I'm sure there are isolated individuals who have been arrested and charged with felonies for certain things, but not, you know, this mass arrest, we definitely weren't charged with any felonies.
Mm-hmm. And so...
You know, I mean, but in that mass arrest, I do want to say, I mean, several people who were caught up in that were not on the freeway, weren't even protesters. For example, there was an African-American gentleman who I was in a holding cell with who was staying at the Marriott Hotel with his girlfriend, the Marriott right by the freeway and right next to the parking lot where we were all arrested. He came out of the hotel to see what all the commotion was and was pretty much immediately told to get on the ground by the police. He was zip-tied so tight that he was, you know, in visible agony for hours. And they refused to listen to him, you know, telling them that he was staying at the Marriott and that he wasn't involved in the protest. And, you know, he was treated like the rest of us and thrown into a...
Which police departments were these? Which police departments did this?
So this was mostly CHP officers at this scene, although there might have been some other departments present, but most of the officers I saw were CHP.
Now, the Berkeley City Council shut down on Tuesday night, I guess voluntarily, although I guess there were plans to shut it down or there were plans to raise issues that might have resulted in its deciding to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Is that relevant?
Yeah. I'm not exactly. I know people were planning or at least talking about, protesting at the meeting, and then it was pretty quickly canceled. I don't know much more about it other than that.
Here in Santa Cruz, there's a debate, I'm sure there is everywhere, you know, of, you know, diversity of tactics versus sort of dogmatic nonviolence. And I'm wondering, you know, Black Bloc as a tactic up in, you know, your area, was any of that used that year to your knowledge during these protests in order to divert attention by police so as to allow people to break out of kettles and things of that sort?
Black Bloc was present at some of the protests, although I must say, I mean, you know, a lot of the vandalism was blamed on Black Bloc. Me personally, I saw a lot of, you know, justified acts of vandalism being committed by people of color who, you know, are rightly frustrated with this system and deserve to vent that frustration whatever way they choose. Much like many, I get a little uncomfortable when I see sort of privileged white people trashing stuff because they're not generally the targets of oppression. You know, they're definitely not the same level of oppression. My philosophy is sort of, you know, however the oppressed choose to respond to oppression is their prerogative, and I have no right to tell them not to respond however they should choose. So when I see oppressed people taking actions like that, I definitely don't have the same sort of feelings about it as when I see more privileged people taking actions like that.
Mm-hmm. So the biggest series of arrests was on Monday night, and there were continuing arrests. These arrests were primarily against, I mean, of course, you know, the newspaper headlines talk about, they don't clarify that these arrests were, you know, for such things as blocking the freeway. At least the ones I'm reading, I don't recall that they said that. But rather, you know, the headlines are about vandalism and broken windows and, oh, I don't know, they assaulted the
window. Monday night there was, I didn't hear of any vandalism whatsoever, especially amongst the 267 people. I believe that's the number. We overheard that from one of the jail guards. The 267 people arrested on the freeway, or, you know, next to the freeway, I should say. No one was arrested on the freeway. There was no vandalism engaged in by those protesters. In fact, you know, most of them were students, and in fact, two-thirds of them were women. Only 90 out of the 260, roughly 90 out of the 267 protesters were men. It was a very, very peaceful crowd. It was very, you know, people were just there to engage in a targeted direct action.
Were these people who actually got onto the freeway, or were they just stopped from getting onto the freeway?
Oh, no, people were on the freeway for hours. I mean, the people marched all the way from Berkeley almost to the Bay Bridge on both sides of the freeway, keeping it shut down. There have been other times where they, you know, blocked people from getting onto freeways. This was not one of those times. There were just too many protesters, and they overwhelmed the police lines, and they weren't able to keep us off.
How did the overwhelming happen? Was this done non-violently or what?
Oh, of course. I should say there was plenty of violence perpetrated by police attempting to stop people from going onto the freeway, but there was no violence perpetrated by protesters against the police in order to break the line. I mean, basically, you know, when you have 500 people facing off against six riot cops, you just have to walk forward, and they can't stop you, you know. I think there were literally like six riot cops trying to keep hundreds and hundreds of people from moving forward on the freeway. I mean, they just started, you know, macing everybody in the front of the line. I got maced, like hitting people with clubs, but that was not able to stop people from exercising their right to protest.
What was the reaction of, people who were getting the surrounding people, if one of their comrades was getting hit by a club? Do they protect the person? Do they back off from the scene? Do they stand and witness? What did you see happening?
Usually you would people will pull people away from police. These cops are in full riot gear with helmets and clubs. You know, even if someone were to push one of them, I mean, you couldn't even make a move. I mean, they're in full body armor. I mean, there is no risk to the police.
What kind of protective gear were the protesters wearing?
A lot of people brought with gas masks in anticipation of being tear gassed. But other than that, I mean, people aren't, you know, say wearing protective, you know,
armor or anything. And, you know, these are students. These are peaceful protesters not looking for a confrontation with police.
And hoping
to avoid a confrontation with police.
I hear you. Here in Santa Cruz, there has been an issue of it's an armored personnel vehicle that the city is getting through Homeland Security for the police department, costing $270,000 or something, somewhere around there. And I'm wondering, were any militarized police vehicles visible in the scene in the last few days in Berkeley?
Oh, yes. I saw several armored personnel carriers, especially on, I believe it was Sunday night, when the worst vandalism occurred. And also very, very interesting. I mean, whenever people were engaging in vandalism, the cops were nowhere to be seen. It was almost that they were peacefully allowing it to happen. And then at points when we were, when the crowds were not engaging in vandalism, that's when the cops would show up and get really violent with people. It really seemed like they were trying to encourage the vandalism so that they could use it as a pretext for, the mass arrest on Monday and for the, incredible brutality that they're using against,
In Santa Cruz, there's been a kind of also a resurgence of the UCSC anti-tuition protests and actions. Has that been happening up in Berkeley as well? And is it?
I was involved with those in Berkeley as well.
Tell me a bit
about that.
They've
sort of died down a tiny bit in Berkeley, but I think they were actually going even stronger in Santa Cruz, last I had heard.
Well, what's been happening? Are these still ongoing, or has everybody gone home to get out of the rain, or what's cooking with that?
Honestly, I think people sort of gotten distracted with these Black Lives Matter protests. I think this is probably a more important issue for people to be focusing on right now. So I'm not really shedding a tear about that. Obviously tuition increases are awful, but so are black kids being shot in the street. So.
Are you a student yourself?
I'm a graduate student.
I mentioned the tuition stuff because the protests took over buildings here, this tuition protest, and then stopped Thanksgiving vacation, perhaps. And then a couple days ago, they resumed.
It was the same situation at Berkeley. We had occupied Wheeler Hall, and then when Thanksgiving came, the occupation ended.
Right, but they resumed here a few days ago. Did they resume in Berkeley as well?
They have not. That isn't to say that they won't. Again, I think a lot of the people I saw organizing Occupy Wheeler protests are now, busy organizing these Black Lives Matter protests. So I think it's just an issue of organizational capacity. But I would be very surprised if protests don't resume in some fashion, especially if the state fails to act to stop those tuition hikes.
Now, in Santa Cruz, we, 20 years ago, used to block freeways, and, in the Rodney King scene, when that happened, the verdict against, where the Simi Valley jury acquitted the cops, and I think there was also massive freeway blockages in the first invasion of Iraq under the elder Bush, but it hasn't, unless I'm wrong, I may be mistaken and forgetting something since, it hasn't happened since.
Definitely not to this scale. I'm sure there have been isolated protests where a freeway was blocked for, a short period of time. But, just in the last, 2 weeks, I think I've seen maybe 4 or 5 freeway blockages just in the Bay Area. Which is definitely unheard of.
So, for those of us who are kind of, I'm trying to focus on, our local police department here. It's also obviously one of the focuses, because I work with a homeless civil rights group called HUF, and I'm a white privileged guy, for sure. And I have, But, you know, the concern I have down here that I've been ranting about for decades has to do with mistreatment of people, black, white, and otherwise, who are poor and who are outside and who are homeless. And we've been raising issues around the police department here of their racial and class profiling. Is this an opportunity up there for any kind of fundamental changes in police department up there, or is that, you think, something that would happen only if there were even more fundamental changes socially?
You know, it really seems that people are not going to allow a return to the status quo. People are going to keep engaging in direct action until there is meaningful change. And, you know, I don't know what shape that might take, but this is an unsustainable, system that that is in place right now. And it's much, you know, the city is going to have to act if they, you know, want to be able to continue functioning in any meaningful way. If every single night protesters go out and smash bank ATMs and, you know, smash bank windows, like, you know, banks aren't going to be able to operate in the Bay Area. Like, that's not a tenable situation. You know, if every single night protesters go out and block rush hour traffic, preventing people from getting home on their commutes, I mean, that's not a sustainable situation. And it's going to require either, you know, dramatic police repression, and, you know, violation of constitutional rights on a massive scale, which will likely just, you know, fuel more protests. It doesn't seem like that's going to be an effective way of, you know, clamping down on any of this. I mean, each time there's a police response, the crowd just gets bigger. But I think that there is going to have to be some sort of, you know, systemic change. And whether that's meaningful or whether it's just sort of like liberal reform that sort of, you know, keeps everyone's blood from boiling too hot, you know, who's to say? But something's going to have to change pretty quickly, I would say. I mean, I think just in the last week and a half, there's been $1.6 million in overtime for police. That the city just can't afford that going forward. That's $1 million a week for all this police. And even then, like, you know, officers can't just work 20 hours a week or 20 hours a day every day. Actually, they'll need to sleep. They'll need to take vacations. They'll need to, you know, spend some time with their families. There's just no way that this can continue. And it really doesn't seem like the protesters are going to be stopping anytime soon.
Now, are you an old-time activist yourself in the sense of, have you been engaged in, stuff in the last few years around social justice issues, or are you a newcomer to this?
No, I've been pretty engaged for a while now. I was pretty heavily involved in Occupy in 2011. And then recently I was heavily involved in organizing the Block the Boat protest in the Bay, where we were blocking Israeli Zim shipping company from unloading goods in Oakland in protest of treatment of Palestinians. And that was actually wildly successful. Zim is no longer coming to Oakland, to L.A., or even to Tampa Bay anymore in response to our direct action against them.
What about unions and working organizations? I did notice, you know, there was a 15-minute support for Black Lives Matter at the congressional staff members all did a little sort of photo opportunity in front of the Congress. But what about, you know, labor organizations, longshoremen? Are they supportive of this stuff? Is there any kind of union support?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in fact, going back to Block the Boat for a minute, we worked very closely with ILWU on that. ILWU Local 10 in Oakland is a majority black union.
And one of the ways that we really built solidarity with them was by drawing connections between the militarization and, you know, violence being perpetrated against Palestinians and the violence being perpetrated by police in our communities here in this country. You know, Israel supplies a lot of the weapons and especially like tear gas and stuff like that being used against against communities of color here in the United States. You know, a lot of the you know, weapons being used against Ferguson protesters come from Israel and in fact are shipped on Zim ships. And what so about, we were able to build solidarity with ILWU Local 10 by drawing.
Well, has that building of solidarity resulted in your getting their support in these more recent protests?
I'm not aware of any direct support for these specific protests. But I can't imagine that, individual ILWU longshoremen aren't paying close attention and even participating in these actions. But it's also very difficult for the union to officially take positions on things. Sympathy strikes are illegal, for instance, and even just making statements in solidarity can put union officials into awkward positions at times. So it's very difficult to see, the organization as a whole really necessarily taking a stand. But I'm sure they're supportive and participating. I will say that my union, UAW 265, which is the graduate students union, the graduate student workers union for all of the UCs, has been pretty involved in organizing and providing jail support for arrested activists and the like. So that, at least as far as our union, there definitely is some involvement. But I can't speak to other unions.
So what can all the sofa bed liberals here in Santa Cruz, where can we tune in to watch everybody walk out to the bridge and get clubbed by the police?
Well, there's generally several live streamers out there, capturing events. Caster TV, I know, is one who's been out there. You can find him on Twitter. I don't live stream, but I'm generally at the protests and in more of a reporting role. I pretty much live tweet the entire time, taking pictures. Honestly, just following Twitter is probably the best way to stay on top of these protests.
There's no particular, website you recommend people go to?
No, again, if you go to Twitter, you'll find whoever is live streaming that day. It's often different people. The mainstream media is beginning to cover these things. There's a CBS cameraman I saw the other day. Mainstream media definitely is coming out, but, they'll probably put 15 seconds of footage on, and that's pretty much it. Twitter is definitely the best way to stay on top of things.
I saw, from Saturday, there was a statement from some organization of journalists upset about a journalist being beaten by police or otherwise abused. Have you been following that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was in a holding cell with a journalist whose press credentials were ignored. I witnessed, there was a cameraman trying to film a police line, and a cop came and jabbed him with his baton and made him back up behind an imaginary line, telling him that he can do his job from over there. To which I would say, well, then why can't that cop do his job from 10 feet away, not touching anybody? If a journalist is expected to be able to do his job from 20, 30 feet away, why can't the cop do his job from 20, 30 feet away? That sort of logic, I guess, is lost on police. They've definitely been very hostile towards the media, very hostile towards protesters. I mean, there was a
I forget exactly what rank, but a high-level police official who referred to the protesters as the enemy, and said that, and was been referring to a journalist, said that that journalist was behind enemy lines, and they were giving him a pat this time. I mean, in order for a journalist to report on anything, they sort of have to be behind quote-unquote enemy lines, whatever the fuck that means. They're definitely treating journalists as the enemy as well.
So we're talking with Fannin of the East Bay. If anybody wants to call in and ask him a question or make a comment, you got a minute or two left. More Fannin, how you doing? How's your time?
Yeah, I can stay on for a couple more minutes.
We'll see if anybody's listening or if anybody wants to call. 469-3119 is the number here. 831-469-3119 if you have a question or a comment. Is this going to ruin your chances of joining the OPD, Fannin?
I can only hope. Actually, you know, when I was arrested on Sunday night, I managed to get my phone out of my pocket while I was handcuffed and was live tweeting events. And one of the CHP officers, I guess, was following social media, figured out who I was, came over, you know, tried to ask me my name. I refused to give my name. I'd already given my name when I was, you know, arrested. I didn't have to give it again, so I refused. But the guy, you know, harassed me and took pictures of me and, refused to say, you know, took pictures of me with his personal cell phone, I should say.
Uh-huh.
Even though I, trying to refuse to allow him to do so, he basically forced me to submit to him taking pictures of me with his personal cell phone. And, you know, very, very clear that he was trying to harass me for exercising my free speech rights.
Fannin, you say that a majority of the people who were arrested were women.
Correct.
And is that because a majority of the people who were unwilling to move were women, or was it because majority of the women, the people that were targeted by the police, were women? What's your sense of that?
No, I mean, that was the makeup of the crowd. There were 300 some odd of us on the freeway, and most of them were women. Berkeley is is usually a safe space for women to feel comfortable to come out and protest, and we're very proud of that fact.
Not anymore, huh?
At least I am personally.
Not anymore.
I still think that. That people will come out. I mean, everyone said that on Sunday when the worst vandalism was occurring that, you know, it was going to scare people away. Well, the next day the crowd was five or six times the size.
On Tuesday and Wednesday it dropped, right?
Correct. Yeah, actually, I was not out the last couple of nights. I have a thesis committee meeting coming up that I needed to prepare for so that I don't get kicked out of school.
What kind of study do you do? If you wish,
I'm a biologist.
Huh. Okay. Oh yeah, I should have known. Okay. Well, look, it looks like we're just getting a mass of calls here, as to say none at the moment. But I appreciate your, giving us the on the spot scene and also, kind of. Well, on the spot scene is what you've given us. Is there more you want to add before you disappear into the crowd, so to speak?
I want to reiterate that people need to accept that the goals of this movement are more important than their views of appropriate tactics. You can't tell oppressed people how to respond to oppression. If you don't like the response, then you have to work your ass off to end that oppression. And that's the only way around it. You can't tell people that they need to stop being on the freeway. You can't tell people they need to stop smashing windows. windows are going to continue to be smashed and freeways are going to continue to be blocked as long as people feel this immense oppression. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, if people want their city back, then they should proactively do something about it.
Any particular suggestions you have about what should be done in Oakland and Berkeley in terms of meaningful changes in any of these law enforcement agencies?
I think that anything short of disbanding the Oakland Police Department won't do. They need to burn it all down, salt the earth, and start over. And that's probably true of Berkeley PD as well. And then obviously, small steps would be, truly independent citizen review boards with teeth. Get rid of this idea of sending cops to grand juries. Grand juries are basically just tools used to whitewash the crimes of the police. They're never used to actually convict anybody or indict anybody, I should say. So we need to get rid of all of this sort of kabuki theater around policing the police and actually put in some very, very strong controls. We need to start throwing people into prison, like these cops. Like, they just, they need to be put in cages. Like, there's no other way around it. You have every 28 hours, an African-American male is killed by police or by an armed vigilante. This is an epidemic. And it's an epidemic that's only felt by certain segments of our society. And it needs to end. And it's going to end or, people are never going to have their status quo back.
Well, there we have it. Hey, thank you. And again, we've been talking with...
Fanon.
And pronounce that one more time for me.
Fanon.
Fanon.
It's a pseudonym. It's taken from Franz Fanon, the revolutionary from Martinique. Very active in the Algerian Revolution and who basically wrote about how... violence of the oppressed against the oppressor is not the same as the violence of the oppressor against the oppressed.
You're talking about the wretched
fact,
of the earth.
Almost opposite.
You're talking about the wretched of the earth. Wretched of the earth, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I always thought it was Fanon.
That was one of his books.
But he was French. It's Fanon. Sorry about that, Fritz. Didn't mean to. All right. Well, monsieur, merci. And. Keep us advised. I do a show on Sunday. If something else comes up you want to talk about or raise issues on, call me anytime between 9:30 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon at the same number.
Sure. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And good luck.
All right. You too. Bye-bye. And this is Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. The rain is still a-coming down. And that was Monsieur Fanon, pseudonym, a graduate student guy up in Berkeley, Santa Cruz, or not Santa Cruz, in the Oakland area, I guess it was, talking about upcoming protests this Saturday. We have our own upcoming protest happening as well. And he gave you some ideas about what he wants, what he thinks should be done. Maybe you have some ideas, 427-3772, if you want to call in, particularly instances in police and in Santa Cruz of police or other interactions that you think need to be revealed and discussed. I usually record a lot of those and have them available. I'm not too well prepared today, I have to admit it. There's been a lot of recent writing, though, on Santa Cruz Indie Media. I recommend people go there. I've been doing a lot of writing. Steve Argue's been writing there. He writes about the Santa Cruz City Council meeting being shut down on Tuesday. First time in really... at least 14 years, maybe longer, 20 years. And interesting stuff. There's a couple of other things that are... a little marginalized on Indie Bay, as ever. Too bad. I always hate it when they put my stuff at the bottom of the doghouse segment, as I call it, on this particular website, which is the lower third on the right. But some of us have been concerned on Pacific Avenue with the tightening of the rules and the restrictions there, and under the guise of loosening of the rules. So there's a City Council of Santa Cruz passed, I don't know, the DOT, what do you call it, Dodoism? Anyway, the new DOT procedures whereby the yellow dots, the blue dots, and the red dots will define where you can set up a table, play with an open guitar case, sit with a sign that says need spare change with a little cup or cap in front of you, or have a vending device of any kind where you're, I don't know, trying to sell your scarves or show your artwork for donation or your crafts of any kind. That will go into effect on December 25th. This new law was passed, which it doubles the space in a particular area that you're allowed to be in terms of what is supposedly allowed now from 12 square feet to 24 square feet, three of those squares on Pacific Avenue to six of the squares. But in fact, the actual number of places you can be is diminished because there are only these static areas where you're going to be allowed to be. And I had a kind of a dialogue with activist Tom Noddy about that. I'm going to talk a little bit about that before I leave the studio. But one of the things I asked the city council member who voted for this crap, Micah Posner, and the people who brought it back to council were Don Lane and Pamela Comstock, sort of the pseudo-liberal and the real-life reactionary, Pamela Comstock, in order to essentially recognize that the existing anti-performer laws that they put into place last year, they just can't do. I mean, police, if you walk up and down Pacific Avenue, you'll see everyone is ignoring those laws, and police are just arbitrarily going after people whenever they feel like it, but not that much, because it's you cannot operate within the laws, really, with any kind of comfort or... I was going to say reliability. That's not the right word. Less than 1% of the sidewalk under the current ordinances is allowed for sitting, spare changing, vending, tabling, performing. After December 25th, that will expand to 2% of the sidewalk, because the actual area that you'll be allowed to set up a device in will be, instead of 12 square feet, it'll be 24 square feet, which is, you know, that's an improvement. But the real question that I and members of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, have always raised, or I've raised frequently, and I think others have too, is why do you need these kinds of restrictions at all? Where are the specific police problems that actually require this to happen? And they have never been really shown by any either... Even anecdotal evidence has not been presented with any clarity and specificity and a well-documented form. They simply have decided, the Downtown Association or Candy Jackson of Jackson's Shoes, who initiated this stuff back in 2003, or, I don't know, Neil and Ryan Coonerty. Actually, it was Neil Coonerty then, back in 1994, who gave us the original forbidden zones on Pacific Avenue. And again, by forbidden zones, I mean areas where you're not allowed to do any of this stuff. You can stand and speak. You can't sit down. You can't have a table. You can't do any of the normal kinds of things that happen along Pacific Avenue and have happened for the last 30 years, without a lot of problems, except that merchant associations and conservative staffers want to regulate and control and repress and create a different kind of downtown, it seems like. It's hard to say what the real, you know, the internal motivation is. Anyway, HUF members spoke with Micah Posner, the council member, and I as one of them asked Posner to set up regular office hours where street performers could come and give their input, as well as other people from Pacific Avenue who are affected by these ordinances, in the weeks and months ahead. Since they did not allow that at all, let's put it this way, there was no provision made for this when this the geniuses behind the scenes, Scott Collins and Julie Hendy, the staffers, created the current dotted zones that you're going to see up and down Pacific Avenue. Presumably they'll have to be maybe put in again after this huge rainstorms, or maybe not. And they will be going to force on December 25th. So it's an opportunity. Posner finally agreed. First he wanted to talk to Don Lane, you know, talk to the master. And then Don didn't want to be a part of that, and maybe until February, you know. But finally Micah agreed to do this. He will be available tomorrow at 3:30 if you want to go to his office. 3:30 tomorrow, Micah Posner, council member, will be in his office. I'm going to call him tonight to confirm that that's going to be the case, although he would prefer you call him at 420-5028. And I'm seeing this as a way of encouraging people to speak up about their concerns, abuses, and so forth, and to maybe have some very minor deterrent effect on police abuse. I don't think the police give a shit about Posner. But as a city council member, you know, they may there may be a slight deterrent impact. And I don't think he cares a lot about this in the sense that he's willing to speak up about it and take some actions on it, make press statements about it, demand staff reports on it. He's not willing to do any of that stuff, I don't think. Although, you never can tell if things might change. But it does provide an opportunity for people to kind of get together and realize that the power they have is in a kind of solidarity together in raising issues, and that there can be a focal point for this. And the focal point is not to rely on Posner at all, but possibly to use this awareness that there can be regular reports. Maybe people can start putting out their own street shit sheet, as I used to put out myself, about what's going on downtown. And let the community know. Of course, you know, through the social media, as our last speaker talked about. Anyway, 3:30 tomorrow, City Hall, if you want to meet with Posner. I believe that is happening. Let's give him a call and see if that is the case. Assuming I can get the proper number. I think we got it. And we can leave Micah a message if he's not around.
Hello, this is Micah.
Hi, Micah. Robert on Free Radio. I've just announced that you will be available at 3:30 tomorrow to meet with folks if they want to brave the rain, if you want to brave the rain. Is that still
That's
the case?
True. What's that?
Is that still true?
Yeah, I'll be there for half an hour anyway.
Okay, and I've also advised people to give you a call at 420-5028 in the future, or maybe even for tomorrow, to give you a heads up. 420-5028, and but you're going to be doing this at 11 o'clock in the morning and subsequent Fridays.
Yeah.
Okay. Any reports to the community about anything that's happening you want to pass on before I leave you?
Well, it looks like the stay away ordinance, you know, has been put off until January 14th or so.
I think it's the 11th.
Right. Uh-huh. So, you know, to me that seems like kind of an important piece of...
Yes, but the council was disrupted.
Policy.
How can you countenance that kind of vicious behavior by malcontents in the community?
I don't countenance it. I think it prevented us from having a better discussion about the armored rescue vehicle. I think we could have arrived at something where it wasn't used for protests, I think. But anyways... So I don't think it was really super effective, but I understand people are upset.
So you felt that that there would have been a better discussion if people had acted differently in the chambers?
Definitely.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder, after the people were excluded from the city council chambers, council continued to meet. I saw seven of you sitting at the dais. What were you guys talking about?
Just what to do about the rest of the agenda. We just talked about, you know, procedurally how to put it off and where to place it and blah, blah, blah.
How long did you talk about that for, do you know?
I don't know, 5 minutes.
And another point, you and other council members all left the room because I was speaking with my back to the council at various points. What were you guys doing in the back room there?
The mayor wanted to figure out whether you were allowed to do that, and she figured out that you were allowed to do that, so she came back in and gave you the rest of your time.
Was there much controversy about that? I mean, was there much discussion or debate?
We didn't debate anything. We just, you know, we took a recess because things were sort of getting heated, and we were hoping that, you know, if we just, instead of trying to clear the citizens out, we thought maybe if we just left for a minute. I didn't think this. She's the mayor, but I think the idea was twofold. One, maybe if we left, it would just sort of calm things down rather than trying to clear you guys out with police. That's never advisable. And then the other thing is she just wanted to look at the protocols and see if there's a protocol about whether you needed to face the council when speaking. She found out there wasn't, so she came back in and gave you the rest of your time.
By saying look at the protocol, what do you mean?
There's protocols for how the meetings are supposed to be run.
Are these written in public?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, I know there's no statement that says you must face the council, but was she suggesting, and are you saying that if they decided to create a rule that said every member must face the council, that that would somehow be constitutional and justify her arresting people who don't face the council?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it would be constitutional, but if it was legal and there was a rule, then I don't think. And you refuse to leave, I guess you could be, I don't know what the mayor would do. It's kind of like the tape recorder thing. Like, she thinks your tape recorder violates protocol, so she holds up her vision of her version of the protocol taking your recorder away or blah, blah, blah. I mean, the protocols, the mayor enforces the protocols with help from the police. It doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's arrested.
Well, she puts me in the ridiculous position of having to sit next to a tape recorder, which I suppose, if I feed on, at least lets me see the audience more specifically, but it's kind of peculiar, and I've always been surprised that no member of the council hasn't said, you know, why don't we just dump this? This is ridiculous. Leave the tape recorder there, let the guy return to the side of the room where he usually is, and let's proceed. And
I think the new mayor is going to figure out a different solution to this conflict.
So before people, I mean, this and it's interesting because we can't see this on the tape and the audio yet. Do you have any idea, were the cameras ever turned off? Was there an ending to the videoing that happened once? I know I did was I came up, and once the mayor tried to essentially castigate and require an individual to face her while he was talking, even though I think he just intended to make a point to the audience and the entire council, she rigidly demanded that he turn back to her. That just made me decide it was time to make it really clear that violation of a city council rule is not a disruption unless it disrupts in the sense it stops the meeting. If the mayor stops the meeting, then she disrupts the meeting, and that's
the
problem.
Well, it's clearly a disruption this time. I mean, the protesters clearly disrupted the meeting.
Well, no, but I'm talking about the point where I got up and turned my back on the mayor, and all of you decided in disrespectful response to leave the room. You know, I mean, that to me is an indication of, as I say, disrespect for a member of the audience speaking. But what I'm curious about is who made the decision to leave the room? And was there, I didn't hear anybody say the meeting is recessed or anything. Did you guys recess and go into the back room?
We did. Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
And then the seven of you conferred back there?
No.
No?
No.
Uh-huh.
I went to the bathroom personally.
You did? Well,
and I think there were some cookies back there.
You didn't go all the way to Front and Laurel Street, I take it,
no.
To the Posner poo-poo machine, yes.
As you know, there's a public bathroom right outside the council chambers as well.
But it isn't open at night, unfortunately. Maybe you can take some action to make sure that they...
It's not open during the meeting?
Oh, it's open during the meeting.
I think it's usually open till, yeah.
But it's not open 24 hours, and it certainly could be.
Right, right.
But, of course, if it were, you'd be arrested walking to the bathroom, since it's illegal to be on the council grounds late at night.
Okay. Yeah. This seems like this is a pretty clean substitute at this point. I have a bunch of dishes to wash. Is there anything else that you need help with?
Let's just remind people that you will be in the office tomorrow at 3:30, and people can reach you. You'd prefer they reach you at 420-5028 if they're coming?
Yeah, at least leave me a message or something.
Okay, well...
But, if that's an imposition, people can just show up.
Stay dry and keep your playing cards with you at all times.
Yeah, thanks. I hope everyone's staying dry and somewhat warm out there tonight. It's definitely difficult.
I guess I could think of about 1,500 people who aren't, actually.
I know, I'm worried about those people, too.
Are you?
Yeah. Okay, good night.
Thanks, Micah. Bye-bye. That's Micah Posner, city council member, and... you can read more about this on Santa Cruz Indie Media, but it pretty much we've summarized it. If you want to meet with Posner on Pacific Avenue stuff, and presumably he may be even more broadly focused than that, or allow a broader focus than that. And you can read about it on Santa Cruz Indie Media. Posner sets office hours for input around street performer and other Pacific Avenue stuff. That's getting pretty close to the end of the time now. What's interesting about it sounds like one of the things that happened at the city council meeting, and I'll be referring to again on Sunday, that happened the day before yesterday, was the city council. May have made a reasonable decision in excluding people from the room from their point of view after the cry of shame, shame, shame went up. I think it's ridiculous for Posner to claim there would have been a more meaningful discussion without it, because the cry of shame went up after the vote where Posner was the only one opposing it, and he gave a sort of a weak-kneed explanation of what he was doing. He didn't clearly distinguish himself by demanding to know why there was a specific hurry in this issue, by requiring to know what the exact date deadline was for the issue that we had at hand, which was accepting the grant for this armored personnel vehicle that Deputy Chief Steve Clark and Chief Kevin Vogel wanted. Anyway, they kicked people out of the council chambers. They kicked everybody out. But then instead of allowing people back into the chambers when they resumed their meeting, they did not. They locked the doors. In fact, they closed the door on one woman who reported her hand was injured by Lieutenant Flippo, who wouldn't let her in. And some people were angry enough that they banged on the windows and said, "Let us in, let us in." And they wouldn't. Even though they were meeting behind closed doors, all seven of them, in violation of the Brown Act, which requires that the public be admitted. No, they don't have to admit people who are disruptive, but they have to admit the general public and the media. And I was not allowed in. The police chief himself refused to me entrance into the meeting, Kevin Vogel. And I have some of this on tape, but I have to say the tape was not very good. And the problem I have is that I've been using this kind of makeshift recording equipment because I never know when their Sergeant-at-Arms, Sergeant John Bush, he's also a police department sergeant, is going to confiscate my tape recorder if I walk too far away from it, go to the bathroom, and so forth, like Micah Posner did during his time in the city council, as he talked about. So the tape is pretty bad, and I'm hoping that we can get a better tape from the actual city council audio. But again, you can't trust the audio because the mayor directs when they're going to turn it on and off. And if there is, if the mayor decides that what the audience is saying is disruptive, she can shut down the cameras so the people at home cannot see it, cannot hear it, which... it's interesting. In any case, I think that we'll do more in research of this or more documentation of this on Sunday when I come back, assuming that we haven't all aren't all blocking the freeways and camping out there on Saturday night. Hopefully the weather is going to be better than it is tonight. And we'll see what happens then. If you want to read more about this issue, there's a lot of stuff on Santa Cruz Indy Media, both the protest upcoming on Saturday, the Tuesday actions at City Council, and the stay-away order stuff, which Micah Posner and I were discussing briefly. And that's all discussed online. I will read a little bit before I go about, As I was saying earlier in the show, Tom Noddy, who's a professional bubble performer and a guy who's been involved a lot at different points in trying to either restore or establish maximum freedom for street performers, at least. And also, I think he has some sympathy for homeless people, though we have disagreed on the advantages of separating these groups and